everyone, and welcome to episode 54 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cybulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. This week, the Medieval Podcast has been sponsored by Podcorn. It's a new online marketplace built to connect podcasters and sponsors so that both can find themselves the right fit that works for listeners. Podcorn's handy-dandy list feature makes it possible for podcasters to choose sponsors that they like, and the same goes for sponsors. It also encourages collaboration between creators and sponsors so that you, the listener, get the information that you can use in a less boring way. And to me, that's a win-win. Because I care about what you hear when you listen in, Podcorn gives me both freedom and control on what I bring to you and how I bring it. So thanks, Podcorn, for sponsoring this very cool episode. You can find out more about Podcorn and how it works at podcorn.com. This week, I thought we would talk a little bit about anchorites, and I want to do this not because I'm making light of the isolation that a lot of us are facing in the face of the global pandemic, but because something I realized looking online is that a lot of people right now are starting to turn to different places for comfort in this time. And a lot of people are turning to the words of Julian of Norwich. And I thought this is a good time to talk about Julian because I do think her words are very comforting. And we should talk about Julian in terms of anchorites because it's something we haven't talked about before. And also, I mean, anchorites are kind of topical when you think about isolation. So we're going to talk about anchorites today. A lot of what I know about anchorites, I'm supplementing a bit today with a couple of books from the Teams Middle English Text series, which is free for people to read online if you like. The first one is Ancrenawissa, which is edited by Robert Hassenfratz. And the second one is The Showings of Julian of Norwich, and that one's edited by George Ronan Crampton. So both of those are ones that I'm going to be kind of referring to. They inform what I know about anchorites on top of the stuff that is in the back of my brain. So let's talk about anchorites. The first question, of course, is what is an anchorite? And an anchorite is either a man or a woman who's decided to go into isolation as part of a religious practice. So they're not necessarily monks or nuns. They could be people with no religious background per se, no religious education or training. But not just anybody could be an anchorite, because what an anchorite was is somebody that was physically enclosed for the rest of their lives. And so not just anybody has the temperament for that, as you might imagine. So not just anybody could enclose themselves and call themselves an anchorite. There is a process that people went through in order to actually become anchorites. It was the bishop that was in charge of anchorites, kind of nominally. They were part of his kind of umbrella of religious people that he was taking care of. And this makes a lot of sense because anchorites often built their cells onto a church. So, I mean, the bishop is in charge of the church and its property. So it makes sense that the bishop has a say as to who could become kind of an official anchorite. A person who wanted to become an anchorite would have to kind of apply to the bishop, explain why they wanted to be an anchorite, explain why they thought they would be able to do this for life, and they would also need to be able to show that they could be supported for life, that they had a patron or they had the support of the community, that they were not going to become, I guess, a drain on people's resources, because once they were enclosed, they couldn't go and take care of themselves the way somebody would outside of an anchor hold. That's what their cell would be called. They couldn't do their own grocery shopping, for example. They couldn't buy toilet paper. Okay, maybe that's not a fair joke. But they couldn't go out and buy their own groceries or clothing or anything like that. So of course the bishop needs to be sure that these people would be supported and taken care of, that they wouldn't be starving in their cell. So we know that they are going to be enclosed. We know that they need support from the community to do that. And so the bishop is making sure that is there. But the question is, when the bishop was asking someone, like, why would you become an anchorite? This is really kind of an important question. Why would you become an anchorite in the first place? You could become a nun. You could become a monk. You could become a priest if you like. There are different. You could become a beguine. We talked about beguines a couple of weeks ago. So why would you become an anchorite in the first place? It's very extreme. Well, we know that in all sorts of religions all over the world. There have been hermits. So this is not a new thing in the Middle Ages, and it's not exclusive to Christianity. So a lot of religions have different people who go out and enclose themselves somewhere, often, you know, in the desert or in a cave, in the case of Tibetan Buddhists, for example, and they would go out and contemplate the spiritual life. And this is what anchorites are doing, but usually within a city attached to a cathedral or a church. And if any of you are out there observing Lent right now, you are already engaged with this whole Christian idea of understanding the suffering of Jesus. So you, if you're observing Lent, you're observing that 40 days when Jesus was in the desert being tempted by the devil and suffering. And so, you know, this is something that you're familiar with in terms of Christianity. So there's the example of Jesus in the desert, but there's also the example of people who were called the Desert Fathers, who were hermits that had stories told about them in the Middle Ages, where they would spend their whole lives out in the desert, where obviously conditions are extreme, and they would be contemplating the spiritual life. And so there were a lot of stories of Desert Fathers that were being told in medieval Europe. So these were an example of people who were an inspiration. And also, there were other anchorites living in each country. In England, we know the height of it seems to have been in the 13th century. And there was like 150 or more anchorites in England at that time. So you could actually perhaps have seen an anchorite yourself and been inspired by them to be one. Now, I was talking about how we know that some Tibetan Buddhists, for example, went into caves in the mountains to contemplate their religion. And Buddhists will often practice in a way that's dedicated to other beings. And that phrase that is often used is, may my practice be for the benefit of all beings. And that's kind of a beautiful and simple way to say it. And I think that anchorites probably have the same idea, where part of the reason that they were enclosing themselves and engaging with this suffering, this life of deprivation, was for the sake of the community. They were taking on this suffering, I think, partially in order to help their communities. This is an idea that I have, and obviously the reasons for each person to become an anchorite would be different, but I think it's probably very similar to what we have when you have Buddhists, for example, saying that they are devoting their practice for the benefit of all beings. We know that when people pray, they are often praying for everyone outside of themselves in all sorts of religions all over the world. So I think that part of being an anchorite probably was for the benefit of the community, as well as the spiritual benefit of the anchorite themselves. So I've said that an anchorite is somebody that is enclosed for the rest of their lives. Now, we know that human beings are, well, they are what they are, and some of the anchor holds that we have some evidence for seem to have been more luxurious than other ones. It seems that the suggested size of an anchorite cell would be 12 square feet, which is tiny. I think there's a lot of prisoners that have about 15 square feet. So 12 square feet is a very, very small cell for you to spend the rest of your life in. We know that sometimes anchorites had different rooms. So perhaps they had one room where they would have their window onto the community, and another room for sleeping, for example. But again, it was different depending on who the anchorite was, what their background was, what the time period was. So it varied. But overall, when you became an anchorite, there was a ritual that would be gone through. So they would build the cell onto the side of the church. And there's a reason for that, which I'll get to in a second. But they'd build the cell for you as an anchorite. And then they would start to perform a ritual for you, which involved giving you your last rites and performing the order of the dead. So basically, the person who is an anchorite was becoming dead to the community. And as this service was going on, that person would be bricked in and enclosed. Now, this is, again, it's very extreme, right? Some anchor holds apparently had a door to a servant's quarters, which would have a door to the outside world. So it wasn't, you know, being buried alive, exactly. But it was kind of being buried alive. That was the idea, and that's why they were given their last rites. I imagine that that first night as an anchorite would be quite scary. You know, you're definitely sure that you're ready for this, and then all of a sudden you are bricked in, which is, it's very extreme. And I think it would be quite the moment for an anchorite that first night. An anchor hold would have been attached to the side of a church so that they could have a window, the anchorite could have a window onto the church so that they could observe the service that was happening in the church and participate within their cell. So they were usually attached to the church so that they could participate from the four walls of their cell. So they could see things like the priest elevating the host, for example, and that would obviously help with their contemplation. They would also have a window to the outside world so that they could speak to people. I mean, they were enclosed and they were kind of thought to be dead to the community. But at the same time, we know that human beings don't do very well in isolation. Even if they are the most amazing spiritual athletes, you need to have a little bit of community. So they would have a window that would allow them to speak to people outside. This wasn't just to the benefit of the anchorite themselves, but also to the community, because these people were respected as, and again, like spiritual athletes is something that is that Robert Hasenfratz mentions in his introduction to the Anchor in Orissa. But also, people did think of these people as being kind of elite in their spirituality, and they were taking on the suffering that other people did not have the courage to do. So these people were kind of the pinnacle of the most spiritually dedicated in the community. So having that window was not just for the benefit of the anchorite, but for the community to come and speak to this person, get their advice, get their blessing, and learn from them as well. In fact, the Anchor in Orissa, it's very medieval Christian in that it's saying, well, you can talk to people on the outside, but don't have too much fun. Like, don't become a teacher from the inside because you're supposed to be enclosed. You're supposed to be contemplating stuff by yourself. Don't start being super social. That's not what it's for. So obviously people were being pretty social through that window. We know that people were visiting anchorites for blessings, for advice, that kind of thing. And also, I mean, for practical reasons, if a person is enclosed in a small cell, they can't do their own cooking. They can't empty their own chamber pot. They have to pass this stuff through the window. So that is another reason why you'd have a window. I think when you think of people being enclosed, maybe it's just me, you kind of picture the window as having bars, probably because the only people we picture in cells like this are prisoners. But maybe some of the windows had bars, but some of them couldn't have bars because you have to get your meals somehow, in some way. So it's not exactly like solitary confinement. People were able to communicate with the outside world, and the meals and things like this were passed through at least once a day. Now, according to the Anchor in Orissa and the information that was gathered by Robert Hasenfratz, we know that anchorites were fed by their servants or by the community once a day in the wintertime around lunchtime, and twice a day in the summertime around lunchtime, and then later in the evening. And it probably wasn't the most luxurious food, but again, you know, I guess it depends on who the anchorite was. So these people, they are enclosed, they are interacting with only a few people. So for all of the people that are in isolation right now, and I myself have been in self-isolation for 6 days, so I have some questions of these anchorites. And one of the obvious questions, I think, is what do you do all day as an anchorite? You're enclosed, you know, there is contact with the community, for example, but what do you do all day? Fortunately, there is kind of a schedule that's laid out in medieval Christianity, which is the canonical hours. So the anchorites could pray according to the canonical hours and follow that routine. So there was a routine and a structure to their days, which followed the canonical hours. So, you know, at certain times of the morning, that's when you would begin your prayers, begin your chanting, begin your hymns, and you would be continuing that throughout the day. But there were times during the day when you weren't supposed to necessarily be reciting anything specific. So what could you do? From the information that I've gleaned from Georgia Ronan Crampton's stuff on Julian of Norwich, it seems that most of the men who were enclosed were clerics. And if they were clerics, then that means that they could read and write. And so these were things that they could definitely do. Someone could pass a book through the window for them to read, or pass them some parchment and ink and they could write. Julian of Norwich must have been writing herself. That's something that she could do. if it was a woman, and apparently the majority of people who are anchorites in the Middle Ages were women, for whatever reason. I'm not sure what the reason is, and I'm not sure anybody has come to a definite conclusion about this, but it seems that most of the anchorites were women. For a woman who's uneducated, what she could be doing is charitable stuff. She could be doing things that she had learned how to do, for example, textile work. That's something that she could easily work on during the day. But we do know that to follow the canonical hours and to pray these exact same words every day would lead any human to some boredom. We know that being an anchorite was a difficult thing because, well, again, human beings, they have trouble. They struggle with too much repetitiveness and not enough contact with the outside world. And so there are stories of hermits, for example, and anchorites who are visited by demons and visited by temptation. And whether you take this literally or you take it figuratively, it was a difficult thing to be an anchorite because you are tempted by the boredom to think perhaps uncharitable thoughts about what you're doing there, about what the purpose is, about what the point is. And I remember seeing Robert Hassenfratz speak at Kalamazoo, at the International Medieval Congress in Kalamazoo, and hearing him talk about a priest who was ministering to an anchorite that was having suicidal thoughts because they couldn't come to terms with what they were doing there anymore. And the priest did think of it not in terms of psychology as we do now, but in terms of temptation by the devil, by demons, or a difficult moment in this anchorite's life. I don't know what the source for that is, but once I find it, I will share it with you. But it just kind of goes to show that even if you are a spiritual athlete, it's difficult to be enclosed for that long. So if you're in self-isolation right now, understand that it is difficult. And even the people who were devoted to this as a life practice did struggle with it as well. So if you're having trouble being isolated, go easy on yourself. It's not just you. It's a difficult thing to be enclosed. So imagine doing this for life. And this is not to wind anybody up, but to think about what it would be like to be an anchorite. So these people are meant in a way to be forgotten by the community, to be thought of as a dead person. But in order to be an anchorite, you needed the support of the people. So imagine what that was like if you're enclosed on the outside of a church. Maybe you have a brazier for yourself. Maybe you have a fireplace if you're super lucky, but you are dependent on the people outside to bring you food, to bring you blankets. And if they get sick or forget about you, it's very, very difficult. So in a way, these anchorites were, their lives were in a way kind of more public than some monks and nuns' lives were, because when you went into the church, there was the anchorite's window and you'd see them and you'd have to be kind of aware of them. The community needed to support them in order for them to do their work as an anchorite. So it's kind of interesting. It's an interesting place for them to be, where they were alone but also supported by the community. It was a very difficult life for people to choose. And so, you know, whether you're religious or not, I think this is kind of an admirable thing to devote your life to just one thing in a way that leaves you being tested all the time. This is something that, you know, I definitely could not do myself. And so I do think anchorites are very interesting in the life that they chose. I think probably the first place where I came across learning about an anchorite was learning about the showings of Julian of Norwich. And like I said, Julian is kind of the reason that I wanted to talk about anchorites today, because I've noticed that people are looking to her words for comfort. And Julian is a really great example of, I think, the way medieval Christianity wanted people who were anchorites to work. And what I mean by that is, Julian was not only a successful anchorite in that she spent a lot of her life enclosed. We don't know if it was, you know, her entire adult life or just part of her adult life, but she spent a very long time enclosed. And what she came out of it with was a very deep understanding of Christianity in terms of its best self. Like, I know that we look at medieval Christianity and we tend to think of it as being intolerant and ready to burn people at the stake. But really, if you look at it closely, medieval Christianity was about those teachings that you see in the New Testament, where Jesus is asking his followers to extend mercy, to extend kindness, to extend love towards their neighbors. And this is what Julian of Norwich comes out with. And this is what Julian of Norwich distills her understanding of Christianity into. And it's really quite beautiful. Let me introduce you to Julian so we can get to this, because I do think if you haven't come across Julian of Norwich, it's really kind of a beautiful thing to see. So we don't actually know what Julian's real name was. She seems to have been named after Saint Julian, as in the church where she was enclosed. So we don't know what this woman's name was. And all we really know about her comes from her writings and people making donations to her so that she can be supported, and people visiting her. So we don't really know much about Julian at all, except for what she has written. And what she had written seems to be very precise. It's kind of interesting. So Julian was an anchorite in the late 14th and early 15th century in the town of Norwich in England. And we know about her because she wrote about her visions. She had been given visions, and then she wrote about them in what seems to have been a short text and then a longer text. And it's possible, as Crampton says, that she wrote the short text kind of fairly soon after she had her visions, and she wrote the long text later when she'd had time to think about and really contemplate these visions. But when she writes about them, she's actually very specific. She said that she had these visions on starting on May 8th, 1373, which is very, very precise. I think something that you rarely see in history, but this is what she says. So Julian says she was very, very sick for many days, for 3 days, 3 nights. The fourth night, they thought she was going to die. She hung on for a few more days. Her priest brought her last rites and brought her a crucifix. And by then, Julian says she was basically ready to die. She was expecting to die. And she looked at the crucifix and felt a great sense of well-being. And then she asked to understand Jesus' suffering better in that moment. And she was given 16 visions. She does say in her book, The Showings, she does say what those 16 visions were. You can look at it yourself. The Middle English is actually very, very friendly for you to read. And there's great notes by Crampton, so you can see that. So she has 16 visions. And these visions they kind of follow along the lines of what was a trend in late 14th century Christianity, which was something that is called affective piety. This is a kind of a practice that many women were involved with, where the contemplation that they had of Christianity was very focused on the body of Jesus, the body of his mother, the Virgin Mary, and the emotions that Jesus was experiencing, but even more what Mary was experiencing, and even what Mary Magdalene was experiencing. So this affective piety was a way of thinking about their religion that was emotionally involved and really kind of focused on the body. So when I talked about medieval drama last week, I talked about how a lot of humor and religion in Christianity in the 14th century was based on the body. And this is not humorous, obviously, but this type of affective piety was focused on the body of Jesus and of Mary as well. And if we think of an extreme example, I know on the podcast we haven't talked about Marjorie Kemp, but if you know Marjorie Kemp, she's an extreme example of affective piety, where she's always thinking about Jesus, for example, his crown of thorns and the blood. And Marjorie Kemp is just weeping all the time thinking about it. So she's kind of an extreme example. But Julian's showings kind of follow this affective piety and how it worked. There are a few things that are really, really wonderful about the showings of Julian of Norwich. And again, this is whether you're a Christian or not. I don't tend to be a very religious person, but I do find Julian's work very touching on a human level, because she is not somebody who went through a church education, probably. She writes in a way that's very accessible and speaks human to human. So when she talks about her sickness, It's very immediate. And when she talks about the suffering of Jesus that she saw in her visions, again, it's very immediate, and you can really sense her feelings. You can sense the feelings of the people that she's describing, whether it's Jesus or Mary. It's very immediate. It's very evocative. And it's not the type of thing that, you know, you might often see when you look at more structured writing of the Middle Ages. And Georgia Ronan Crampton, when she's talking about the introduction, when she's doing the introduction to the showings of Julian Norwich, she talks about something that I think is another remarkable thing about the way that Julian writes, and that is when revelations are given to her, she tries to describe them, and she describes them kind of as a way of, she understands them without it being tactile, without it being spoken. She tries to tell you and really describe to you these things, these ideas came to her without any speech. She just knew them. And again, I think this is kind of a beautiful way for someone to describe their visions as just knowing this thought. And obviously, this is something that she has been thinking about for a very long time. When she was six, she said she was around, well, she said she was 33 and a half years old. But she was enclosed for a long time after that. So these showings that she has finally written down, she's been thinking about for a very long time and processing them in a way that allows her to explain them very clearly. So somebody who's got a very, very difficult life like Julian, she's enclosed. It's probably very uncomfortable most of the time. It can be boring. It can be something to make you feel depressed or struggling. She's chosen a very difficult road. But what she gets out of it is only goodness. I don't know if you've seen, there is a book out there that's by Archbishop Desmond Tutu and His Holiness the Dalai Lama, where even the cover of the book, they're just smiling at each other and they're just talking about the joy that you can have in life. And this is where you find Julian as well, where you see people who are at the pinnacle of enlightenment, perhaps, and what they get out of it is joy and love. And I think that is it's gorgeous. So the thing that I'm seeing people passing around in the face of this coronavirus, when you see things that are happening, you have no control over them. People come back to Julian's words. She says, Jesus said to her that all things shall be well. All things shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well. So I'm going to give you a translation from Crampton's team's version of it. And I'm going to translate Middle English on the fly, so it might be a bit of a mess, but here you go. So, and this is in chapter 32. And she says, one time our good Lord said, all things shall be well. And another time he said, you shall see yourself that all manner of things shall be well. And in these two, the soul took a few understandings. One was this, that he wants us to understand that not only does he listen to big things and to great, but also to little and to small, to low and to simple, to one and to the other. And so he means in that he says, all manner of things shall be well. For he wants us to understand that the smallest thing shall not be forgotten. Another understanding is this, that there will be deeds evilly done in our sight, and so great harms taken, and that to us it seems that it was impossible that ever it should come to a good end. And upon this we look sorrowing and mourning, therefore, so that we can't rest us in the blissful beholding of God as we should do. And the cause is this, that the use of our reason is now so blind, so low, and so simple that we cannot know that the marvelous wisdom, the might, and the goodness of the blissful Trinity. And thus he means, when he says, thou shalt see thyself that all manner of things shall be well. As if he said, take now heed faithfully and trustily, and at the last end you shall see truly all of it in the fullness of joy. And thus, in these same five words that I've said before, I may make all things well, etc., I understand a mighty comfort of all the works of our Lord God that are to come. And so this is kind of what I mean by Julian. She not only says that God said to me, all things will be well, but then she explains it in a way where I kind of picture her explaining it at the window of her cell, where she's explaining it, saying, you know, God's saying when he said this to me, he's saying that the big things are looked after and the small things are looked after. And even though we can't see it because we are so upset by the evil that we see, we know he's saying to us that all things will turn out well. I've seen the showings of Julian of Norwich also being called divine revelations of love. And this is because when she gets to the end of the showings, what Julian has taken from her visions is that this is all about love, divine love. And so from the end of this is from chapter 86, she says, "And from that time it was showed to me, I often desired to understand our Lord's meaning. And 15 years afterwards and more, I was answered in spiritual understanding this." Basically, he's saying this. "Would you like to understand the Lord's meaning in this? Understand it well. Love was his meaning. Who showed it to you? Love. What did he show to you? Love. Why did he show it to you? For love. So hold yourself in that and you will understand and know more in the same, or know more of the same. Thus it was I learned that love was our Lord's meaning. And I saw full truly in this and in all that when God made us, he loved us. And that love, it was never slaked. It never ran out. And it never will. And in this love, he's done all of his works. And in this love, he's made all things profitable to us. And in this love, our life is everlasting. In our making, we had the beginning. But the love wherein he made us, so the love that he made us from, was in him without beginning, in which love we have our beginning. And so all this shall be seen in God without end, which Jesus may grant us. Amen." So again, this is one of these things where, you know, and I keep saying this, this is the type of thing which is very grounded, obviously, in Christian theology, but it's the type of thing that people do find comfort in when things are so difficult. What is it down to? I mean, the Beatles told us the same thing, right? All you need is love. It's all about love. It's the only thing that money can't buy you. So when I think about the anchorites, these people who chose this difficult road, who chose to enclose themselves and contemplate the spiritual life for their entire lives in isolation, even if this did mean, you know, some contact with the community, some understanding, some contact. I think if somebody could come up with what is the goal of this, what do you hope to get out of this? I would think it would be the showings of Julian of Norwich, where you've spent your entire life contemplating what is the meaning of life. And the meaning of life, according to Julian, is love. You can find the showings of Julian of Norwich in a really friendly Middle English version, edited by Georgia Ronan Crampton, on the Teams Middle English Text Series website, along with the more difficult Ankara Nawissa, which is edited by Robert Hassenfratz. All sorts of other Middle English texts are there for you, too, to read for free, along with introductions and notes. The site is d.lib.rochester.edu/teams. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's going on the website and in the medieval world. What's going on, Peter?
Hi, Danielle. Well, I guess it's a lot of coronavirus news is kind of permeating the medieval world with many cancellations from museums to conferences. And the latest conference to be canceled is the International Congress on Medieval Studies, which is the largest academic gathering. It takes place at Western Michigan University every year and brings in about 3,000 people, including we're amongst people that go to it as well. But unfortunately, they've had to cancel it, along with many kind of other things that are happening with social distancing and quarantine, things like that. So in medieval studies, we're kind of seeing that have an effect on like scholarship in the academic world as well.
Yeah. I mean, I was scheduled to speak there. We were going to do a roundtable on podcasting, but I think this is the right call. I think that we need to stay home.
Oh, for certainly. Most important thing is keep everyone healthy. And, you know, this conference will probably the exact same stuff will actually probably take place next year. That's already the kind of plan, is to whoever was speaking, scheduled to speak this year, will speak next year. And I think this is going to be a lot for, you know, medieval academics. It's just like we will reset in a year, hopefully.
Yeah, exactly. And we're keeping things going with medievalist.net, right, on the website?
Yeah, yeah. We're trying to have a bit of a mix of stuff that's kind of related to coronavirus. So you can read about the medieval origins of quarantine. We are also having kind of the regular kind of material. You can read about St. Patrick and werewolves in honor of St. Patrick's Day. There's also a piece about how researchers have confirmed that bones from the 7th century belong to an English saint. So a lot of interesting things still happening in the medieval world. And we'll try and give you new content every day, keep you something interesting to read.
Good. That's great. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks. Stay safe.
I know that there are a lot of people who, like me, are practicing social isolation or self-isolation, or are in quarantine right now all over the world and listening to my voice. And I want to tell you that it's a privilege to spend this uncertain time with you. The Medieval Podcast is going to keep on going on during all of this, and we have a whole lot of great episodes already to keep you company. I hope that it brings you some entertainment, some learning, and some comfort. Hang in there. Thank you to all of those people who are on the front lines caring for the rest of us, whether it's in hospitals or in the grocery stores. We are grateful for all the ways you support and help us, as people did for the anchorites so long ago. Thank you. It's also worth thanking the people who are supporting this podcast on Patreon and making it possible for me to keep it going for you while the world is upside down. If you have a little to spare, please visit our Patreon page, where we have some goodies for you, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare magazine, which you can get digitally or on paper, or a book with our Boydell and Brewer book club. You can find it at patreon.com/medievalist. As always, you can follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalist to keep yourself both busy and informed. You can also find me, Danielle Sobolski, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5minutemedievalist, so feel free to reach out. There's another human being on the other end. For more indoor entertainment, you can find my new book, Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, along with my other books on Amazon. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thank you for listening, and may all manner of things in your life be well.